The camp was 200 miles north of the Zambezi. There were 1,500 recruits housed in the thatched barracks. Most of the instructors were Chinese. Tungata's instructor was a young woman named Wan Lok. She was short and broad, with the sturdy limbs of a peasant. Her face was flat and sallow, her eyes slitted and bright as those of a mamba, and she wore a cloth cap over her hair and a baggy cotton uniform like a suit of pyjamas. On the first day, she made them run 40 kilometres in the heat, carrying a 40-kilo pack. Equally burdened, she kept easily ahead of the strongest runners, except when she doubled back to harangue and chivy on the stragglers. By that evening, Tungata was no longer supercilious and scornful of being taught by a woman. They ran every day after that. Then they drilled with heavy wooden poles and learned the discipline of Chinese shadow boxing. They worked with the AK assault rifles until they could field-strip them while blindfolded and reassemble them in under 15 seconds. They worked with the RPG-7 rocket launchers and the grenades. They worked with bayonet and trench knife. They learned to lay a landmine and how to boost it with plastic explosive to destroy even a mine-proofed vehicle. They learned how to set a mine under the black top of a macadamized highway by tunneling in from the verge. They learned to lay out an ambush on a forest path or along a main road. They learned how to make a running defense in front of a superior fire force while delaying and harassing it. And they did all this on a daily ration of a scoop of maize meal and a handful of dried kapenta, the smelly little fish from Lake Kariba that looked like English whitebait. Zambia, their host country, had paid a high price for supporting their cause. The railway line to the south, that crossed the bridge over the Victoria Falls, had been closed since 1973, and Rhodesian task forces had attacked and destroyed the bridges into Tanzania and Maputo, which landlocked Zambia's only remaining lifeline to the outside world. The rations offered the guerrillas were sumptuous fare compared to those of the average Zambian citizen. Starved to the leanness of greyhounds and worked to the hardness of iron, half their nights were spent in the political rallies, the endless chanting and singing, and shouted massed responses to the commissar's catechism. What is the revolution? The revolution is power to the people. Who are the people? Who is the power? After midnight, they were allowed to stagger away to the thatched barracks and sleep, until the instructors woke them again at 4 o'clock in the morning. After 3 weeks, Tungata was taken to the sinister, isolated hut beyond the camp periphery. Surrounded by instructors and political commissars, he was stripped naked and forced to struggle. While they shrieked the foulest abuse at him, calling him running dog of the racist capitalists and counter-revolutionary and imperialist reactionary, Tungata was driven to strip his soul as bare as his body. He shouted aloud his confessions. He told them how he had worked with the capitalist tyrants, how he had denied his brethren, how he had doubted and backslid and harboured reactionary and counter-revolutionary thoughts, how he had lusted for food and sleep and had betrayed the trust of his comrades. They left him utterly exhausted and broken on the floor of the hut. Then Wan Lok took him by the hand, as though she were his mother, and he her child, and led him stumbling and weeping back to the barracks. The next day he was allowed to sleep until noon, and awoke feeling serene and strong. In the evening at the political rally, he was called to take his place in the front rank amongst the section leaders. A month later, Wan Lok summoned him to her sleeping hut in the instructor's compound. She stood before him, a dumpy, squat figure in her rumpled cotton uniform. "Tomorrow you are going in," she said, and took the cloth cap from her head. He had never seen her hair before. It fell to her waist, as thick and black and liquid as a spill of crude oil. "You will not see me again," she said, and unbuttoned the front of her uniform. Her body was the colour of butter, hard and immensely powerful. But what startled and intrigued Tungata was that her pubic hair was as straight as that upon her head, without any kinking or curling. It excited him inordinately. "Come," she said, and led him to the thin mattress on the dirt floor of the hut. They did not use the drifts on the return, But they crossed the Zambezi in dugout canoes at the point where the river flowed into the immensity of Lake Kariba. In the moonlight, the stark silhouettes of the drowned trees were silver and tortured as the limbs of lepers against the starry sky. There were 48 of them in the cadre, under a political commissar and two young but battle-tempered captains. Tungata was one of the four section leaders with 10 men under him. Each of them, even the commissar, carried a 60-kilo load beneath which they toiled like pregnant hunchbacks. There was no place for food in their packs, so they lived on lizards and bush rats and the half-incubated eggs of wild birds. They competed with the hyena and vulture at lion kills for the putrefying scraps, and at night they visited the kraals of the black peasant farmers and emptied the grain bins. They crossed the Chizarira hills and struck southwards through trackless forest and waterless wilderness until they hit the Shangani River. They followed it southwards still, passing within a few kilometres of the lonely monument in the Mopani forest, which marks the spot where Alan Wilson and his patrol made their last heroic but futile stand against the impi of Gandang, son of Mzilikazi, brother of the last Matabele king, Lobengula. When they came to the lands of the white farmers, their work began. On the dirt roads they laid the heavy landmines that they had carried so far upon their backs. Freed of this onerous burden, they attacked the isolated white homesteads. They hit four farmhouses in a single week, secure in the knowledge that the security forces were no longer moving to the rescue of a beleaguered homestead during the hours of darkness, because they were aware that the attackers mined all the approach roads before commencing an attack. So the guerrillas had all night to finish the job and escape. The technique was highly developed by this time. At dusk they poisoned the dogs and cut the ring wire. Then they fired rockets into the windows and doorways and rushed the breaches they had made. At two farms they were held off by dogged defence, but at the other two they penetrated. The horrors that they left behind them were a deliberate provocation to the rescuers, who would come in at first light. What they found might drive the security forces to take out their shock and rage and frustration on the local black population, and in doing so, drive them into the Zipra camp. At last, after 6 weeks in the field, low on ammunition and explosives, they began to pull back, laying ambushes as they withdrew. They abandoned the first ambush after two fruitless days. However, at the second ambush on a remote country road, they were lucky. They trapped a white farmer who was rushing his wife, suffering from a peritonitis following a burst appendix, to the local hospital. The farmer had his two teenage daughters in the vehicle with him. He almost broke through the ambush, but as the armoured vehicle passed Tungata's position, he jumped up and ran into the road behind it. He hit it in the soft rear section with an armour-piercing RPG-7 rocket at point-blank range. The farmer and his eldest daughter were killed in the blast, but his sick wife and the younger daughter were still alive. The political commissar let the boys have the dying women. They queued up and took them in the road beside the shattered vehicle, one after the other. When Tungata did not join the line, the commissar condescended to explain, "When a honey guide leads you to the hive, you must leave him a piece of the comb. Since the beginning of history, rape has always been one of the rewards of the conquerors. It makes them fight better, and it will madden the enemy." They left the road that night and moved back into the hills, back towards the lake and sanctuary. Ballantyne's scouts caught them in the middle of the following afternoon. There was very little warning, just a tiny Cessna 210 spotter plane circling high overhead. And while the commissars and the captains were still shouting the orders to deploy and set up a perimeter, the scouts came in. The delivery vehicle was an ancient twin-engined Dakota that had seen service in the Western Desert during World War II. It was painted with grey, non-reflective paint to thwart the infrared seekers of SAM-7 missiles. It flew so low that it seemed to scrape the ragged, rocky crests of the kopjes, and as its shadow momentarily blotted out the sun, the fighting men spewed out of the gaping belly port. The olive-green umbrellas of their parachutes popped open only seconds before they hit the ground. As the silk flared, they were down. They landed on their feet, and even before the parachutes settled softly in billowing folds, they had snapped their harnesses and were running forward firing. The Commissar and both veteran captains were killed within the first 3 minutes, and the scouts swept forward, rolling up the green panic-stricken guerrillas against the foot of the kopje. Tongata, acting without conscious thought, gathered the men closest to him and led them in a desperate counter-attack down a shallow donga that bisected the line of scouts. He heard the scout commander give the order on the bullhorn. "Green and red, hold on your position. Blue, clean out that gully." The distorted voice echoed against the hills, but Tongata recognized it. He had last heard it at Kami Mission, on the night Constance was murdered. It turned him cold and clear thinking. He judged his moment finely, and then pulled out of the donga, under the whipping crackle of the FNs. His calm steadied the men with him, and he started the running defence as Wan Lok had taught him. They were in contact for 3 hours, in contact with elite battle-hardened troops, and Tongata kept his little band in hand, and they counter-attacked and laid AP mines behind them and held at every natural strong point until it was dark. Then Tongata broke off the contact and pulled his men out. By that time there were only 8 of them left, and 3 of these were wounded. 7 days later, in the morning before the dew dried, Tongata opened a passage through the cordon sanitaire, probing with a bayonet until he found the key to the pattern, and he took his men across the drifts. There were only 5 of them left. None of the wounded had been able to stand the pace, and Tongata had personally finished them with the commissar's Tokarev pistol to save them being interrogated by the pursuers. In the town of Livingston, on the north bank of the Zambezi, opposite the Victoria Falls, Tongata reported to Zipra headquarters, and the commissar was astonished. "But you were all killed. The Rhodesians claimed on the television." A driver in a black Mercedes with the party flag fluttering on the bonnet took Tongata up to the Zambian capital of Lusaka, and there, in a safe house on a quiet street, he was ushered into a sparsely furnished room where a man sat alone at a cheap pine desk. "Baba!" Tongata recognized him immediately. "Ngozengulu, great chief!" The man laughed, a throaty bellow of sound. "You may call me that when we are alone, but at other times you must call me Comrade Inkunzi." Inkunzi was the Sindabeli word for a bull. It suited the man admirably. He was huge, with a chest like a beer keg and a belly like a sack of grain. His hair was thick and white, all the things that the Matabele venerate, physical size and strength, and the hair of age and wisdom. "I have watched you with interest, Comrade Tongata. Indeed, it was I that sent to fetch you. I am honoured, Baba. You have richly repaid my faith." The big man settled lower in his chair and linked his fingers over the bulk of his stomach. He was silent for a while, studying Tungata's face. Then abruptly he asked, "What is the revolution?" The reply, so often repeated, came instantly to Tongata's lips. "The revolution is power to the people." Comrade Nkunzi's delighted bull bellow crashed out again. "The people are mindless cattle," he laughed. "They would not know what to do with power if anyone was fool enough to let them have it. No, 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 it is time you learned the true answer." He paused, and he was no longer smiling. "The truth is that the revolution is power to the chosen few. The truth is that I am the head of those few, and that you, Commissar Comrade Tongata, are now one of them."